Good evening. At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, begin the FICnet. The gathering, the clan, we teach each other how to get more enjoyment out of ham radio and how things work. How Mother Nature really behaves. That's sort of what we're seeking. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. I'll start off by taking the roll. Mel, are you present?
Yes, sir.
Present and accounted for. Rich, N2EO, are you present?
Yes, I am, Dick, N2EO, with a question.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Paul, WS2N, are you present?
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock. This is...
And Eric, KE2EJ, are you present?
Net, time.
Okay, two guys haven't passed the muster yet for showing up. Do we have anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters right now and name.
KC2TUX, Bill.
Joe, question.
Okay, we got Joe, RYY, and Bill, TGX. I think it was KC2. Is it TGX, Bill?
KC2, Tango Uniform X-Ray.
Can't even read my own writing. Tango Uniform X-Ray. Okay. So we got Rich, Bill, and Joe. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name. And that yes right now.
Into GOT Mobile, no.
Okay, GOT no. Anyone else?
BB2BXO Mobile also just listening. Hello, Dick.
Oh, BXO with a no. Okay, anyone else?
Kilo Bravo 1, November Hotel. No, just listening.
Okay. Rich, you're the first one on the flight line. Warm up your engine, take off from Whitestone, K2, N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO, we'll say good evening to everybody. Dick, I have a question. It concerns ham radio and in combination with another subject. You know, I got all the tube equipment downstairs, and I sent you and Mel, as you know, a picture of the ham shack, and you remember I have that windowless air conditioner down there sitting by that wall, which divides the ham station with an unfinished furnace room. Well, that space where the air conditioner is, I really need that space to put up a second table for the Collins 7584, and I plan on getting a KWS-1. Known as the Goldust Twins. They called it the Goldust Twins because back in the 50s when that equipment was made, you had to have Goldust to buy it. It was very expensive at the time. But now they're somewhat affordable. It's a kilowatt transmitter, all in one package, sideband, matching the 7584. The problem is that air conditioner is in the way. It's a windowless air conditioner, and that hose that you see in the picture vents out to the unfinished furnace room. What I wanted to do, I don't know if it's possible to do, I wanted to get rid of that air conditioner and put a regular window-type air conditioner in that wall and either let it just vent into the furnace room or use a right-angle duct maybe about a foot long and 2 feet over to a cellar window. Is it possible to do that, or does anybody know, or will the coils just overheat? That's the question, Dick. It always got hot in that ham shack. It's a very tight, insulated basement, finished basement ham shack. And now with the tube equipment down there in the summer, it's just impossible. Back to that, N2EO.
I got an answer for him, this K2KEY.
Go right ahead. You give him the first answer, and I'll give him the second one. You got it, Mel.
Okay, I don't have the ham shack in the basement, but down the basement I still have a shop. And I've got a water-cooled machine that I picked it up secondhand. I used to use it in doctor's offices. They used to call them the rollabout. Had a few hoses rubber hoses connected to them, one to supply the water, the other one to take it away to the drain. And also, of course, electric. You could move it around, but I never really moved it around. However, I saw they have a new system now that, in fact, I saw it in Home Depot. It's a unit that they just hang it on the wall. The whole air conditioning unit actually sits outside or someplace where it can be ventilated, and it just takes this one pipe that ducks it in. So you just have this nice, neat little unit thing hanging up on the wall, Rich. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions about that one, Mel. Is it using the water supply as the heat sink? In other words, your air conditioner is taking heat out of the room and it's got to dump it somewhere. Is it dumping the heat into water, which then goes down the drain? It wasn't quite clear what the water is doing that you were mentioning. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, basically that's what it's doing, because I have a situation that I cannot put it in a window or anything down the basement there, because it becomes a a way of into the house, if you know what I mean. I have, unfortunately, we have to live in sort of like a jail situation here. A lot of robberies take place in this area because it's kind of lucrative. And so all the windows in the basement, which are, it's not a deep basement, but the windows are all barred. In fact, we have bars on all the windows downstairs and on the first floor also. So you can't put an air conditioner into the window or anything of that such or through the wall, because like I say, they will provide a way into the house. So you get these water cool units, and they were used extensively in places where they didn't have a window available for one reason or another. Let me let it drop up, say a few more words about it. Now it uses very little water. It's got a valve control in it that adjusts the water flow just enough to keep the, to cool the system down. In other words, it acts as the coil that's usually in the back of the air conditioner. The, what they call that, the condensing coil, I believe, or whatever. That coil is missing in the system, and it's replaced by, in other words, you're normally venting the heat out into the back chest. This is replaced by the water flow, Dick, over.
And then the hot water goes down the drain, or it gets dumped outside, Mel, which is it? Go ahead.
Well, they give you this neat hosing system. It drops it right into a drain. I put it right in. I tapped it right in. You can get this tap that taps it right into, like, the bottom underneath the sink. You know, you put a T in there, and you tap the water in there, and right next to it you have your cold water supply with a turn-off valve. And that's the whole installation, besides plugging it into the wall, Dick, over. And it, boy, it's cold. Boy, that thing really works extremely well, over.
Boy, that sounds kind of nice. Does it adjust the water supply dependent on the amount of heat you're dumping? In other words, on a super hot day, when the air conditioner is really cranking, does it pump the water through a little bit faster? I mean, one way the machine could work is it measures the temperature of the exit water, and as it comes up to near boiling temperature, it knows to increase the rate of flow of water, and correspondingly on a day that's not so hot, does it slow the water down? Does it automatically adjust water flow rate, or is it something you have to do manually? Over to you, Mel.
It's all automatic. No, it's just the water rate, and in fact, when the compressor kicks off, you know, when you reach the temperature in the room, in other words, the water flow is the independent. It measures, like you say, it's got a thermostatic way of measuring the water temperature and adjusting the water flow. In other words, as the compressor, to keep the compressor at its proper temperature, everything at the proper temperature, it senses it, and then once the compressor, of course, shuts down, within a minute or two later, the water flow completely stops, Dick, over.
Fantastic. What do they call this thing? Is it called a water-cooled internal house air conditioner? And are they a little bit more expensive? I haven't seen such a thing, but I wasn't smart enough to know to look for it. What do they call it? Where do you buy it? And is it more expensive or about the same price for the number of BTUs? Over to you, Mel.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know what the price is. They call it a cooler valve. That's what the name is on. Who the heck makes it? I forgot already who made this thing. And I picked it up. They were doing a renovation. I was at a doctor's office, and they're renovating things, the place, and they pushed this thing out into the hallway. And I asked him, I said, what's going to be with that? He says, it's going to be junk. So I said, gee. And it's on casters. I said, can I take it? Yes, go ahead, take it. I don't know what they cost. They replaced it now with a new unit that sits up on the wall. It's just a basically, looks like a narrow thing. It's very streamlined. It's permanently mounted on the wall, and it's got pipes that go off someplace. I understand it's like that. It's a very simple installation that they put the other part of the system somewhere else, and they put these units just hanging on the wall there, especially, like I say, places where you can't put it in the window for one reason or another. These water jobs were very popular. I know in New York City, in a number of places where they had casement windows, you couldn't put an air conditioner in a window because the casement windows, so they were using these units, Dick, over.
Yeah, somebody should tell us the name of the kind of air conditioner where the evaporator core is the only thing that's inside the house, and then pipes go to a condenser core that's located somewhere else. A split air conditioner is what I call it. It must have a fancy name. Does somebody know the name of one of those?
H-Y-Y. Call the Mr. Slim. It's made by Mitsubishi.
Okay, Mr. Slim. That's good to know. Part of what's going on here, Rich, what I was going to start off with, is that one of the great puzzles that was given in the science class in the high school I went to was you want to cool off a room on a hot day. And you're given two choices. So either put a refrigerator in the room and you're allowed to open the door to cool off the room, or they'll give you a block of ice. Which would you choose? The majority of the class at first chose the refrigerator because it can run continuously. The block of ice, when it melts, it cools the room, but after that it runs out of steam, so to speak. And the answer, of course, was the block of ice. Because what any kind of an air conditioning, refrigeration, any kind of a heat pump system do is it takes the hot substance like air from one place and pushes the heat to some other place. There's got to be a heat sink. So in the case of a through-the-wall air conditioner, there's one flow of air in the house across the so-called evaporator core, which is the coils that get cold, and there's a completely separate airflow on the outside of the house, which is cooling the condenser coils. They're the ones that get hot. So it's pumping the heat by way of the freon from the cold coils in the house to the hot coils on the outside of the house, and two completely separate air supplies. So the so-called slim air conditioner that Joe was talking about, that's one approach, where the condenser coils are outside your house, and a half-inch diameter or so diameter pipe, a pair of pipes, feed the coils that are in the house with this little blower, and they're routed throughout the house by any convenient means to the set of coils that are outside the house to get hot, which has a separate blower. My central air conditioning of my house works that way. I've got a condenser coil and compressor unit sitting outside the house. The pipes go through the house to a 25 or 30 foot length where it goes to the A-shaped coil that's in the airflow of my furnace, 25 or 30 feet away. And one of those pipes is insulated. So you can make the separation between the hot unit and the cold unit of a continuous flow air conditioning system virtually as far as you want. Life gets a little bit complicated if you're going from the first floor to the second floor because the oil that you want to flow back through the air conditioning...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The Freon has to have oil flowing in it, and if it's going up and down a different flight of stairs, so to speak, there's some problems as to whether or not the oil is going to be returned to the compressor. But as long as everything's on the same floor, you can make the distance between the two quite long if you want to. The water flow system is one approach, but it's going to continuously be pouring hot water into your drain. The other approach is to get a hold of a unit that has the real Freon through pipes, and you can make that separation 30 feet. And the hot coils outside the house and on any one of the four walls of the house you like, and the cold coils inside the house, any room you like, and you cut that out to NTPO, to RW and the internet.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Yeah, I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think the water cooled units are illegal in New York City. I'm not sure. I heard that, but I'm really not sure. You know, we have a water meter here, so if all of a sudden in the summer my water consumption went up, they might question that. But yeah, the two-piece unit is a good thought. What was that now? Mr. Slim by Mitsubishi? And about how much does that cost? Can I install it myself? Well, you know, I've got this problem with the hip. It's hard to get around. Who would I get to install a thing like that? I had checked around with air conditioning companies a number of years before I bought the windowless air cool, you know, unit that I've got sitting on the floor. And they were not interested in doing a ham shack. You know, they want to do a whole house.
Yeah, there's a number of brands of these separate units, where there's a simple set of coils and a blower inside the house, the Slim Jim or Mr. Slim, and then the much bigger compressor and its condenser coils outside the house. There's a number of those brand names, and Mitsubishi, I think, is just one of them. When it comes to installing a remote air conditioning system, is my word for it, where you've got the two separated and pipes in between the two, Freon pipes, that installation, I did it myself. In other words, I've got central air in my house. For 15 years, I ran window units and took them out in the wintertime and put them back in the summertime, and a big rigmarole and lots of noise and not as efficient, and I couldn't look out my windows anymore. And all of a sudden, I decided to go to central air, and I saved a lot of money when it comes to electric bills. I got a lot more efficiency, a lot more comfort for the people, and so it worked out very well, and I did the installation myself. At that time, you could buy the raw ingredients from Sears Roebuck, and I claimed that Dick Seals Air Conditioning on Vanderbilt Parkway is going to do the installation for me. Dick Seals Air Conditioning is better known as K2RIW. I mean, they had to know the name of the guy that's doing it. They didn't do any checking, and it was me. They delivered it to my backyard, and I did the installation. It wasn't very difficult once you know what you're doing. The only part that would have been a little bit heavy is the outside air conditioning unit. To put it into the right position, is a two-man lift or a three-man lift. So you're going to have a couple of your friends come over to lift that into the right position to put it on the pad outside the house. But when it comes to the coils inside the house, that's only a few pounds. It's a very light unit, and running the pipes is not too difficult. So I think you have the ability to do it yourself. That's my opinion. Let's see if anyone else wants to add anything to this air conditioning story. But one other thing that I wanted to mention earlier is that in the case of the refrigerator trying to cool the room, you get nowhere, because even though you've opened the door in the refrigerator and at first the cold air from the refrigerator pours into the room, the hot air in the back of the refrigerator is also pouring into the room. You're putting 300 watts of power into it, and you get 300 watts of heat. This is making a very complicated process. So if you don't separate the airflow on the hot side of the air conditioner from the airflow on the cold side, in your case, they're both in the... In your case, they're both in the same basement. You're cooling off the ham room, but you're heating up the furnace room. And unless the furnace room has its way of exhausting the air, half of your basement is running hot, half of your basement's running cold, and unless you've got perfect insulation between the two, some of the air from the hot side is going to flow to the cold side, and it's also heating up the rest of the house, because nobody's house is perfectly airtight when it comes to the floor between the basement and the next floor of the house. So that heat is going into the house. You really want to dump it outside, in my opinion. Anyone else want to add to this? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'll say one more word about this. K2KEY.
Yeah, and by the way, when it comes to a hot water system, I think I can see why Con Ed or New York City would be against it, because in many communities in New York City, you've got a drainage system, a sewer system, where your wastewater from the house goes to a processing plant. And if you're dumping hot water into that system, things are going to grow there, and it's going to make their life complicated. So I can see a possibility that there would be a law against that. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, as far as the hot water is concerned, it's not that hot. And as far as the amount of flow, I questioned all that when I took the unit. instead of hooking the water that's going out through the drain initially, I poured it into a bottle. I had one of these, 5 gallon bottles that, they use on the water coolers. And I wanted to see, how much water am I going to be using approximately an hour, because I got a water meter also. And on the average, I checked it a few times. I'd say about sitting still the 5 gallon bottle up, I'd say maybe 3 gallons, maybe even a little less an hour. And as far as the hot water is concerned, the water that I normally use to wash your hands and go down the sink, I think is hotter than that, Dick. It wasn't that really hot, nor the flow that great, over.
Okay, so washing your hands or taking a shower or a bath maybe is putting the same amount of hot water into the system. And if only a small number of homeowners do it, no problem. But if you had everybody on the block dumping all their air conditioning heat into the water and then dumping it into the common sewer system where it goes back to the processing plant, I see the possibility that Con Ed might be against that, or New York City Water Authority. Somebody's going to be against it. Environmental Protection Agency. I see the possibility. But thank goodness it's not a popular technique. Not many people know about it. And if one more person in Whitestone does it, I don't see it as a real problem. I think you've got a couple of options here, as I see it, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
NYF.
Mr. NYF, start off with your name and then make your comment.
Yeah, how you doing, JR? W2NYF. All right, a split system. Contract, of course, is like $2,000. And they also have residential roll-around air conditioners. And if you had a window in the basement, you could just place this thing on the floor and run a duct to a window to blow the hot air out of the back of the unit. And they go for like around $600-$700.
Very fine, JR. So split system is what we're really talking about. Is probably the best recommendation for him. He's got a specific room he wants to cool, and even though it may be 25 or 30 feet away where the nearest wall or window or whatever is, where wall is what you really want. In my case, I have a cinder block wall. I knocked a hole in that wall. That's where I ran the pipes through to put the condenser coil and compressor system outside the house. And as I said, in my case, that's on the, let me think, east wall of the house, and it's almost the west wall of the house is where the furnace cooling coils are located, and lots of feet in between the two. Installed that way back in 1988, I think it was. It's been running cleanly ever since. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, K2LIW Tech at Limelock, N2EO. I'll say good evening to JR. Yeah, well, I know what JR is talking about, W2NYF. I've already, as I said before, I've already got one of these windowless units that vents out with a hose into that furnace room, and it works. I mean, it doesn't work great, but it works. The problem is, JR, I need the space. It sits on the floor. I'm installing some Collins equipment, and I need that space for another table. Sort of like, I think you have a picture of a ham shack. I think you got it too, Mel. I sent you an email. Sort of, I want to build another table there, which will make an L. One wall and another wall at right angles to put the KWS-1 and the 7584 and the 270T1 speaker, which are quite big. So I need the space now where that windowless unit sits. All right, I'm going to check out these two-piece units. I think I had seen something about that. I had forgotten about that. I'm going to have to check around, I guess, Home Depot. Right now, I guess the best place to check is the web. Look at Home Depot and maybe even DC Richards. They may have something like that. I wonder if I want to have it installed, because until I get the hip done, which maybe will be next summer, not going to go into that, but Todd Bend do anything. If I wanted to have that put in professionally over the winter, what type of company would I go to? I had checked some air conditioning companies years ago for the windowless unit, and like I say, they were just interested in big jobs. They didn't, when I told them it was a finished basement used as a ham radio station, they really didn't want to get involved. Anyway, Dick, let me turn it back to you for final on this, and you go on to the next questioner. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock at 2EO.
Yeah, the word you're looking for is split system, or Slim Jim or something like that, but split system. In other words, freon pipes, a pair of freon pipes, a hot one and a cold one, flows to between the two units. And the best system would be with it both on the same altitude above sea level. When you have to, if you want to cool a second floor room, and if the hot unit on the outside of the house is one floor below her, I think that is less desirable. In your case, that's not a problem. The only heavy object is the compressor and condenser coil system outside, and Barry and you and a friend would easily be able to lift that onto the pad and mount that into the right position. After that, whether you're knocking a hole in the wall, doesn't have to go through a window, a hole in the wall, and whether you're doing that to install a piece of coax cable or you're installing this freon piece of tubing, the degree of difficulty is the same. And the unit that goes inside the house looks to me like it's 25 pounds, if you know what I mean. You and Barry would have no trouble lifting that on the wall and hooking it in, so to speak. So I think there's a moderately good chance you could do the installation yourself and save yourself quite a bit of money. On top of that, because it's not required between now and, let's say, next May or June, you've got lots of time. You can do the whole process very slowly, you know, an hour a day, so to speak, if that's what you wanted to do, as opposed to spending the $2,000 that the installation might cost to be done professionally. And because it's not a big job in the five boroughs of New York City, you're gonna have trouble finding somebody that's willing to take the job. So with crafty guys like you and Barry, I think you can do it yourself. That's a suggestion. So keep us posted as to how that goes. Bill was the next guy who signed in. KC2 Tango Uniform X-Ray. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bill? K2RIW and the TechNet. My name is Dick.
What comment is on this, Dick? K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, as far as the installation, Rich, take a look at, go over to Home Depot. They had him there. I saw him there, the unit at Home Depot. Go in there and ask them. I always bet they have somebody, because I think they install everything they sell. So if you go over to Home Depot, you get a price on it, and they'll tell you exactly, I'm sure, who can install it for you. And by the way, I got the pictures of your ham shack. Very, very nice. The picture of Laura. All came through real great, Rich. Over.
Okay.
Well, very good. Yeah. Especially with all that tube equipment, you have vintage tube gear, the temperature really goes up down there. And when I fire up those 8877s in the summer, it gets impossible. Back to you, Dick.
And one last question on that. You were dumping the heat one wall away into the furnace room. My guess is that furnace room got super hot, and the heat that you were putting into the furnace room, wasn't that going into the rest of the house? Sir Rich, go ahead.
It does get hot in there, but I've got a window in there, so I open the window in the summer.
Which is a partial solution, but the right solution is a split unit with the hot coils and compressor on the outside of the house. Okay, Bill. Yeah, Bill, KC2, Tango Uniform X-Ray, you got it, Bill.
Dick, I was just checking in because I wanted to listen. I didn't really have any specific questions, but thank you very much.
Okay, Joe was the next person on the question of the A2RYY. I thank you for all that nice information you shipped to me, Joe. And I'm amazed what the difference is. Joe and I were having a discussion of two things. One, the relative price of heating your house with gas versus oil, And Joe and I have for a lot of years been buying oil, cash on delivery, spot market, no contract. And compared to all of our neighbors, we think we're saving an awful lot of money. I've seen many a situation where the neighbor with a contract is paying 50 and 75 cents per gallon more than I pay. And there are various people who are afraid of that by saying that, gee, if you buy oil in the spot market, you're going to be getting oil with a bunch of dirt in it and other contaminants. Not true. It all comes from the same source, in my opinion. On top of that, my survey keeps showing me that although people may like the convenience of gas where you don't have to keep ordering oil to be delivered to your house, in dollars per BTU, the amount of heat you get versus the dollars you spend, I'm convinced that gas is a little bit more expensive. Maybe you see it the same way, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Hi, Dick. Good evening. I wasn't going to talk really specifically about oil, but I think you're right about that oil heats best, as they say. And these guys that are full service will basically come and dump oil as on a predetermined, like once a month, once every 6 weeks, they'll just come and dump oil whether you need it or not. That type of thing. You can take 25 gallons, 75 gallons, 150 gallons, whatever it is, they'll just dump the oil on an automatic delivery type of schedule. That's why you pay more for their service.
Yeah, I wait until my tank, my so-called 275 tank, is down to the near bottom. And there are times when they do the delivery, I tell them, what is your price? Because I'm going to buy at least 200 gallons. And on one particular occasion, I hit 240. On one occasion, I ran out, which is not a serious problem. It happened near midnight one night, and the family didn't want to be cold, so I went out to the local gas station that sells diesel fuel, and I bought a couple of gallons of diesel oil and poured it into my tank. It's the exact same stuff. And it's just a little bit more expensive. Yeah, I paid some tax on the couple of gallons of diesel fuel I bought. So, I think you said you had a real question, Joe, so back to you, Joe.
And to Antonio with a comment.
Okay, we'll get to you in a second, Alex. And I'm glad you checked in, because you and I have got to have some more discussions. And not to worry about that. When I was calling the roll earlier, I should have called your name. First, Joe, W2RYY, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, you can let any of you come in there with a question or whatever he wants to do there. That's fine. Let's just take a couple minutes break. Go ahead.
Okay, yep. Alex, you got the floor. WN2NNU, K2RYW.
Yeah, this is November 2, November Uniform. My name is Alex. I'm in Yonkers, New York. Yeah, an often overlooked issue with gas and oil delivery is the quality of the product that you're purchasing. There are probably 10 different qualities of oil and about 15 qualities of gas. So when you buy, which one you buy, depending on the quality of the oil and the gas, they have more BTUs or less BTUs. So that's something to watch. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, as I did investigation on that, oil averages 138,800 BTUs per gallon. It can be as low as 120,000, as high as 140,000. Natural gas also has a range of BTUs. It comes out close to 1,020 is the average BTUs per cubic foot of gas. And so there's some range there. However, the surprising thing when you do research, if you're a person who wants to be green, common sense would lead you to believe that there's more carbon contained in oil, and you think you would be adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by burning oil. Common sense. It's backwards. The total refining process and whatever that goes on with natural gas, and then the final burning of it in your house, puts more carbon granules in the air than oil does. The difference is relatively small, but from that point of view, everyone thinks gas is cleaner. Well, it makes a little bit more CO2, greenhouse gases, global warming of the earth. You get a little more of it with natural gas. I'm not saying people on natural gas should stop using it for that reason. You take, for instance, my buddy who lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas. The whole darn state of Texas has got so much natural gas that oil is essentially unused. my buddy who lives in Texas for most of his life, I've asked him, how many times have you seen an oil delivery truck at someone's home in the state of Texas? And all the years he's lived there, he says, I have never seen that. Everybody there uses either natural gas or ice grid or heating, electricity. Alrighty. When you and I get a chance, Alex, there's further information I would like to give the whole group, and that is, I think you will admit that every amplifier, every filter, every electronic circuit you and I have ever touched, let me drop, when we apply a signal to it with a very brief rise time, a pulse signal, every chunk of electronics you and I have ever touched has a finite rise time and fall time. If it's a filter, the rise time is something in the vicinity of 1 over the bandwidth of the filter. The amplifier, the same thing, the bandwidth of the amplifier, 1 over the bandwidth is the rise time. Every chunk of electronics you and I have ever touched has a rise time. Whether it be a simple RC network, whether it be a complete filter, whether it be a complete amplifier, whether it be an antenna. The only thing I know of that does not have a rise time, and I only own one of them, is a dummy load. The Mori microwave dummy load that I own as part of the calibration kit for my network analyzer at the salt mine, that 50-ohm standard resistor, that 50-ohm reference resistor, is rated flat from 0 to 18 gigahertz, 0 hertz to 18 gigahertz, DC to 18 gigs. So you could say it has a rise time of a picosecond or less, because it's got an extremely broad bandwidth. And at the instant I turn off the signal to that dummy load, the signal within the dummy load dies instantaneously. But every other chunk of electronics I can touch has a finite rise time. That's a fancy way of saying it's got a finite Q, it's got a certain bandwidth. The only way it can have a bandwidth is there is a resonator somewhere, which is storing energy. And once you've stored the energy that creates the rise time, there's going to be a fall time. There's going to be a ring down time. I wonder if what I've said so far makes some sense, Alex. I think you're familiar with it, but I'm saying it more for the rest of the group. N2NNU, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Yes, I understand what you're talking about. I think you're actually referring to the time constant of the circuit itself. This is when the voltage is rising from 10% to 90%, 90% of the capacity of the circuitry. So I think you're talking about the time constant. The issue I had last time is that this is actually better analyzed in time domain rather than in frequency domain. And I was thinking in terms of frequency domain, this is why I said CW. So when it comes to time constant, you actually have to use a pulse, a very narrow pulse, eventually a Dirac pulse, if you can imagine something like that. And there are then certain conditions that you have to apply to the circuit. You cannot just terminate the pulse into going low. You cannot allow the pulse to go low because that will dampen the circuit under measure. You have actually to open the circuitry between your source and the load under research. And this way you have a high impedance and on the load itself, and they can measure the correct time rise and everything else. If you wish, I can make an analogy with water buckets, so everybody will understand what I'm talking about here. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to be asking you to tell us the water bucket analogy. And by the way, when a electronic engineer in his sophomore year or junior year of an electrical engineering college learns about time constant, we first get exposed to it with direct current circuits, DC circuits. So we talk about the RC time constant. You've got a series resistor, a shunt capacitor, you close the switch to the resistor that connects it to the battery, and you measure how much time it takes for the voltage to rise on the capacitor. That's a DC circuit. Well, AC circuits have also a rise time, a little bit more complicated, but from the time you apply a signal generator, making an AC signal, to a filter, an amplifier, or an antenna, some measurements, you'll find out there is a finite rise time in all of those objects, which usually is a function of 1 over the bandwidth. Well, every dipole I've ever used has a certain bandwidth to it. It's got a certain rise time. If it's got a rise time, it's got to have a fall time. It's very similar. Therefore, there's a ring down time. And part of the discussion that created a little bit of confusion last week is we were discussing a very, very brief event. If I've got an amplifier, if I've got an antenna that operates at roughly 1 gigahertz, it's quite possible that its time constant is in the vicinity of 10 nanoseconds, 20 nanoseconds, numbers like that. To make a 10 or 20 nanosecond measurement on an oscilloscope represents a pretty difficult thing to do. There are oscilloscopes called sampling oscilloscopes that go to more than 20 gigahertz of direct sine wave display. But I use the word direct in quotes. It's not really direct. In the old days, to get an oscilloscope to go beyond 100 megacycles was very difficult because the amplifiers didn't have enough power to drive the capacitor plates that are doing the deflection on the gun assembly of the cathode ray tube that's giving you the display. Well, we've gone way beyond that now. That's not a limitation anymore. We're now up the limitation of the writing speed of the phosphor. You can't write a signal from the electron gun of your
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
You can't write the signal onto the phosphor fast enough to go beyond roughly 500 megacycles. The best Tektronix scope I know of... The best Tektronix scope I know of barely goes to 500 megacycles because you can't write the signal onto the phosphor that fast. A sampling oscilloscope doesn't write that fast. If I was going to draw a sine wave and I wanted to do it very, very accurately on a piece of graph paper, I could get myself either the right calculator or a lookup table which has the sine and cosine functions. And I look up the sine for 0 degrees of angle, then 1 degree, then 2 degrees, then 3 degrees. I make 360 dots across the graph paper, and I connect them with straight lines, and now I've got an extremely accurate, very smooth-looking sine wave, one dot at a time. That's what a sampling scope does. It can't write the signal on the phosphor that fast. So on the first cycle that comes by, it measures the, takes a sample of the signal when it goes through zero crossing. On the next cycle, it measures with a little bit of delay with its 1 degree of phase shift. And on the third cycle, 2 degrees of phase shift. And the next cycle, 3 degrees of phase shift, and so on. So a sampling oscilloscope will display the sine wave on the screen for you. In my example, you'd have to have 360 identical-looking sine waves in order to get one of them to display on that screen with 360 dots. It does it with dots. That's what the sampling scope does. So a sampling scope is a beautiful display for very high-frequency phenomena if the phenomena is steady state. If the phenomena is changing in any way, it's going to give you a complicated display that takes a lot more figuring out what is the display telling you, a lot more interpretation required. I got around that problem when it comes to doing a ring down of a very fast circuit when I was out at Edwards Air Force Base 15 years ago by hitting the circuit with not just one pulse and watching the ring down, but hitting it with 1 million pulses per second. Now, my sampling oscilloscope measured the first pulse with zero delay, the second pulse with a tiny bit of delay. I eventually drew on the screen the ring down waveform by not looking at one, but looking at 1 million of them. And I got 1 million dots on the screen. And now I could see the phenomena of the ring down. So a sampling oscilloscope can do it, but you've got to trick it into doing it by making the event happen over and over.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A sampling oscilloscope cannot take one single transient event and display it on the screen. Quite a few very smart engineers have fallen into that particular trap. I was one of them 15 years ago until I figured out what's going on. I know you know this stuff, Alex, but I'm saying it for the benefit of other people. A sampling oscilloscope is a powerful instrument, but it's got a couple of quirks once you figure out how it works and there's ways around it. Tell us your bucket brigade circuit analysis of rise time and fall time, Alex. N2NNU, K2KE1.
K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay. Well, perhaps what you were talking about not being possible to measure, it was valid about 15 years ago. But if that would have been still valid now, we wouldn't have 10 gigabit Ethernet at this time. I will suggest you to look to Tektronix. They have a scope, it's called the ATC-11 and the ATC-08C, which are sampling optical sample scopes at 30 gigahertz. All that you have to do is to convert your signal to an optical, your electrical signal to an optical signal, and that is done with a mixer from Tektronix too. So technology has advanced in the last 15 years. Okay, so analogy. The issue last time was to clarify rise time, or if you will, the group delay, or if you will, the time of reaction of your antenna for the very first applied cycle of the RF. Is that correct?
Exactly. When the very first cycle from my transmitter, and the transmitter might be a tiny transmitter located right at the antenna, or in the worst case, it could be a transmission line between the two. Because every antenna has a finite rise time, the real impedance of the antenna at the instant of the first cycle gets there is not the steady state impedance. That's a very complicated phenomenon an antenna has. If you put the right kind of instrumentation looking at reflected signal, the transient of reflected signal, you'll find out that during the rise time of your simple dipole, you're getting reflected energy, even though in the steady state it's perfectly matched. So the antenna presents a different impedance. It's a little bit like a flywheel with a little bit of a drag on it, and my piston that's pushing the push rod that's starting up the flywheel, it has to push harder to accelerate the flywheel on the very first cycle, so to speak. The flywheel has a different impedance while it's speeding up compared to the impedance it has when it's running steady state. There's a lot of analogy between flywheels and stored energy, and LCDs and stored energy, and antennas and stored energy, amplifiers and stored energy, filters and stored energy. Almost everything you work with has particular bandwidth to it. There is stored energy, and it usually presents a different impedance on the beginning of the transient versus the impedance it presents during steady state. Lots of people fall into the trap of not catching on to that one. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay. All of that is common sense for everybody that works in electronics. However, it's totally inconsequential for the common radio amateur because who cares about the first cycle? Well, as long in the next second the antenna is tuned correctly, I don't care what it is in the first cycle, as long my power amplifier is not burning during this time. So, let me try this analogy. So we have a generator, an RF generator, connected to a feeder cable that is now connected to a load. So let's call it an antenna, if you will. In the mechanical world, in the fluid world, we will have a pump, we will have a series of buckets, all with the same capacity, and they are connected together with little pipes, so one bucket, when it fills up, can overflow in the next bucket. With the exception that the last bucket is much, much larger than the one in the room. Let's assume then we have 10 buckets simulating our feeder, and the last bucket is the antenna with a much, much larger capacity. Those buckets represent the delay through the cable, through the feeder cable, and it takes a certain amount of time for the signal to propagate from the generator to the load. So the generator starts to generate power, feeds up to the first bucket. The first bucket starts to fill up, but the wave is not propagating yet because it didn't reach the pipe, the overflow pipe, and so on, until it gets to the overflow pipe and it starts to flow into the second this is 1 unit delay now into the cable. So that happens until the one before last bucket is happening, is filling up. And now we're coming for the effect that Dick is talking about, the delay until the last big bucket starts to spill out into the ether. It will take much longer because it is much larger usually than the rest of the buckets. In a nutshell, that's what it is. Back to you.
I like it. That does explain the way a transmission line works. In the case of the transmission line, those individual buckets, which have to be filled, the early ones have to be filled before the later ones get any fluid into them. Very similar to what happens on the usual way some books will represent a transmission line. They will represent a transmission line as a whole bunch of series inductors and a whole bunch of shunt capacitors. Choose the right inductor-capacitor ratio, and you're choosing the right impedance of transmission line. Until the current flows through the first inductor, and that current in turn starts charging the first capacitor, which is shunted with it, and then that in turn can charge the next inductor, that gives you some of the function you get with a transmission line. That piece of RG has a velocity factor of 66%. In other words, the radio signal flows down that cable 34% slower than it does in free space. 66% velocity factor, which is accounted for by the individual buckets along the length of the transmission line from Alex's analogy, or my analogy, the inductors and capacitors that are charged in series, in sequence. Believe it or not, your nerves, your biological nerves that are up to your brain, works by a fairly similar process. The signal is passed from cell to cell. It's a chemical signal, a slightly electronic, but mostly chemical, and it's passed from a shock wave and water flowing through, an acoustic wave and water flowing through it. You could talk about the vibration of the individual molecules. Almost everything has a delay, which could be shown as a bucket brigade, like Alex is showing. And once the transmission line is fully charged with signal and it's coming out of the end, there is stored energy in that transmission line. Anything that's got a delay has stored energy in it. And so that if you suddenly disconnect the signal you're putting into that transmission line, which is the equivalent of Alex suddenly stopping the water he puts into the bucket.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Out of the exit tube of the buckets that got in the beginning of the process, water is still flowing between those buckets downrange, and it would take a period of time for all the energy in the transmission line to finally be dissipated. That phenomena that I'm now describing is the method that's used by many radars for the pulse-forming network. If you wanted to make a radar transmit a pulse of exactly 1 microsecond, there is a circuit that's often used in the radar world, which is literally a transmission line, where you charge the transmission line with DC voltage. You stop charging it, so to speak. You close a switch. As the energy gets drained out of the transmission line into your radar transmitter, it'll give you that energy for a finite period of time and then abruptly stop. And if you do it just right, you make a very clean pulse-generating network for your radar with a delay line. Back to you, Alex. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Okay. In a sense, that's what I wanted to say, except that to measure accurately and to analyze accurately and to simulate accurately the measure... the delay line, the delays through a RC network, not an RC network, sorry, an LC network, a resonant circuit, you cannot use a pulse that is complete. In other words, you have to use an incomplete pulse. This is created by disconnecting the source from the circuit to the falling edge of the pulse.
pulse. If you don't do that, then the falling edge of the pulse will dump the circuitry drastically, and you will measure your measurement will not represent the reality. Usually, this simple pulse is generated just by a switch connected to a very high voltage power supply. So you close the switch, and now the pulse is going on the rise edge, on the rising edge, and you measure your whatever you have to measure. And you open the switch, and the circuit is now the resonant. The switch is a very high impedance, and so you can have measurements done very accurately. Back to you, Rich. Dick, sorry.
Yeah, there are some very accurate timing circuits that use the phenomenon that Alex is now describing. Another thing I wanted to mention, let's see, what the heck was it now? The queue of circuits, one of the things that you'll, as an electronic engineer, you'll finally hear quite a bit about is circuit queue. Queue like the letter Quebec, it really means quality factor, and in many cases it's related to bandwidth. Queue has about four different definitions when it comes to electronic circuits. If you have a filter, and you measure the upper and lower 3 dB bandwidth, frequencies were both of 3 dB in response from the center frequency, and you divide that bandwidth into the center frequency, so center frequency divided by bandwidth, that's one definition of Q. Another definition of Q is that somewhere in the circuit the voltage rises compared to what you apply to it, and the voltage rise at resonance is called Q. The current rise at resonance is called Q. The time constant of a circuit is called Q. Also, a ring down time, you can relate that to Q. And one of the other definitions is stored energy per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Divide the energy dissipated per cycle into the energy stored per cycle in your LC network, LCR network, and that's a definition of Q. There are four definitions of Q. Q can be as low as a little bit less than one, and it can be almost a million. If you take a very high quality, let me drop. If you take a very high quality quartz resonator, quartz crystal oscillator circuit, and if it's very carefully mounted in a circuit that suspends it in such a way that it's not damping the crystal, and if the crystal itself is in a vacuum environment, you can get very close to a million Q. At least 500,000 on a very high Q oscillator. Let me round off the number and say it was 1 million. If your crystal, your reference crystal, had a Q of 1 million, and if it was running at 1 megacycle, and you use that as a filter, that filter would have a bandwidth of 1 hertz. I said megacycle, I should say megahertz. It's running at a frequency of 1 megahertz, it'll have a bandwidth of 1 hertz. That's a filter. Last week, Mel and I were talking about the filters that Mel was building when he was buying a whole bunch of crystals and selecting them and building a lattice network, and he went all the way up to 8 crystals to make a very high-quality filter. He was making the Manhattan Beach equivalent of a Collins acoustic resonance filter, but he was doing it with quartz crystals. So you could get a crystal, in theory, with a bandwidth of 1 hertz. Ain't that amazing?